Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike Desah, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest this week is Andy Circle, Strategic Initiatives Manager for Raven Industries, a leader in precision ag, aerospace, and defense technologies. Andy's role with Raven is to help guide them into new and promising markets through analysis, intelligence, and customer relationships. Since 1956, Raven has designed, produced, and delivered solutions to the agricultural market, earning a reputation as an industry leader in autonomous technology. Like many of our guests, Andy recalls the struggles of growing up on the tail end of the farming crisis. So many aspects of his family's livelihood were outside of their control. When he left the farm to join the U.S. Air Force as a linguist, he vowed never to return. However, 10 years and a world's worth of experience later, Andy found himself again back in West Central Illinois to care for his ailing father. This time, he felt different, though. He felt armed with a set of skills in information gathering and communications that he could put to work in the ag sector, specifically technology. He's been there ever since. Have a listen to this episode as Andy describes this transition and some of the autonomous solutions they're creating at Raven and what they believe the future holds on this front.
As you hit high school, you start to realize what life's really like as you struggle through times. You know, the farm we were at had cattle and hogs, and you know, even growing up through high school, just the amount of work and 7 days a week, 365 days a year, no matter whether it was Christmas or New Year's or Thanksgiving, you still had to go out and take care of these animals. And then try to balance that with planting and harvesting of crops too. And it was just, you know, it was a lifestyle that seemed to have rewards at the time, but big picture and long term, when I started to look at what do I want to do with my life and where do I want to go, it was just not something that I felt had the reward necessary to put in all the effort. And you know, depending, your whole livelihood is very much dependent on how things are going in the farm, you know, whether the farm's doing well and you get paid well or you don't, and that makes life very difficult. And I wanted more security and long-term stability at that time. So I made a choice. My father served in the military, is in Vietnam, and it was just something that I've always been very, very proud of, being an American. And I thought that I could be better served in what I thought at the time that I wanted to do in life, and this would aid me in getting there and be able to do a very noble thing by serving my country.
While it wasn't something you wanted to do long term, are there instances or are there nuggets of value that you have extracted from those experiences?
Huge value added by working that, because, you know, sorting animals and washing hog buildings and doing all those jobs that no one ever wants to do makes you realize what you have when you get to a level in a corporate management world that, yeah, you look back and you understand, hey, bad days aren't bad, first and foremost. And second of all, it teaches you a work ethic that you wouldn't ever have otherwise if you hadn't gone through. You know, it gives you an appreciation for where you go when you come from and done those harder type jobs.
What branch of service was your father in Vietnam?
He was in the Army. He was an infantryman. He carried the radio in Vietnam. So, you know, and again, a different world from Vietnam to when I served. He wore a radio that was so big he couldn't stand up and put it on. He had to sit down and put it on and stand up. And right. And now I went into the Air Force in 19, right at the beginning of 98 into 97. And the technology changes just in those, you know, 25 years was unreal. And now where we are today, it's just another unreal step.
What, if your father was in the Army, what was the draw for the Air Force for you?
He was absolutely against me going in the Army after the way, you know, the Army is very much in, I mean, Army people may disagree. They're very much a do it because I said kind of a branch, and the Air Force was at the time, and I believe still is, more ran like a corporation, you know, even back to the, when they had changed the uniforms of the Air Force to be more of a blazer type look, it was to look like corporate America and have a, more of a suit on than the unique look of most military uniforms. So that, with the jobs that was offered in the Air Force and where I believe I wanted to go at the time in life, I thought that gave me the good conduit to get there.
What was that path you thought was right, you know, in the Air Force?
For a small, weird world, I grew up thinking I always wanted to be an FBI agent, so which is one of the reasons that I chose linguistics, and I became a linguist in the Air Force. It was quite an ordeal to become a linguist in the Air Force. You had to pass a test at the front end of that, and then get accepted into the program and go through a very intense language training. I had six, so I learned Spanish. I had 6 months to learn Spanish. So we went to, that's all we did was go to Spanish school at Defense Language Institute Foreign Language Center in Monterey, California. The military has a very unique school there. They bring instructors in from all around the world, so that you need all the different dialects and different ways of speaking. Spanish is a very big worldly language that is spoke very differently from Spain to Mexico to to Argentina, and those dialects, even regional dialects, are different. So you know, we were fortunate enough to have instructors even from Cuba, so to have that ability to get at that time wasn't even allowed to travel to and from Cuba, to have that really broad horizon of instructors to get us what we need to get into the real world of the military was priceless.
6 months to learn Spanish. I mean, what was the process that the Defense Language Institute uses to do that so quickly?
So, you know, you got 2 weeks, and the first week and a half, pretty much you go through the English language learning, I shouldn't say learning, reviewing verbs and nouns and adjectives, because if you don't understand in English, there's no way that that can relay over to Spanish. And then you start your first lesson in Spanish, and you know, it's every 2 to 3 days you have a huge vocabulary list and start in. On day, I think at that time, 14, there was no English spoken at school. I mean, if you had to come up with it, you had to ask, you know, ¿cómo se dice? And then the English word is, how do you say? And unfortunately, I mean, at the time we thought, oh, this is horrible, but it's really about immersion. And, you know, today I don't practice Spanish. I do nothing. But if I go to a Spanish speaking country within a week, I'm coming up with words. I'm like, I have no idea how I know that. It just comes back to you. Kind of like riding a bike, it just takes a little bit longer to balance yourself.
Right. So after that 6 month course, to the extent that you can, give us a sense of sort of what that early military career looked like for you.
Yeah. So, you know, that was the language part. So I actually was in about a year and 3 to 4 months of training. The follow-on training to that was, now what are you going to do with that language? And I went to Goodfellow Air Force Base, where it was, we had a SCIF. Don't know where to skip this. Secret Department that. Information. So it's got all the buildings, no windows. And we would go in there and we would listen to previous things that had happened in the world and have to, you know, translate them and transcribe them and then, you know, make decisions on whether that was actionable intel. Because there's, you know, there's understanding the language, there's transcribing, and then there's understanding whether it's valuable or not. So, and whether that gets sent to an analyst for immediate reaction, or you know, it's just a day-to-day type thing that doesn't require immediate action on somebody's part.
How much education, either formal or on the job, was there in translating the information that would come in into intelligence, right? Because I know that that's a difficult process. How did they educate you on that?
A lot of trial by fire, really. I mean, when you got to after school, I mean, you can only do so much with old style cuts of listening that we've had on the docket. But on the job, you know, we had a list of certification task lists is what we had. Mm-hmm. And you had somebody sitting with you for probably the first 4 to 5 months, and you would make a decision and they would be there over your shoulder to say yes or no to every one of those decisions. As you got into it more and more, really, it just became a second nature. You have to understand, you know, there's a bigger picture of this. There's understanding what the world's looking for, what the intel world's looking for, what the targets are. There's a huge understanding of what that is so that you can prepare for that and know whether it's actionable or not.
How long did you do that kind of work in the SCIF?
So it's interesting. So I did that for probably a year, and then I was promoted to supervisor of that that area. Probably did that for another 6 months, and then I was promoted again to in charge of training for about 300 multi-service individuals, and worked for a GS-15 at that point. And then I was actually stolen from there to go work directly for the first sergeant commander of the largest squadron in the Air Force, 850 people. So I was very much a frontline manager for the first sergeant and commander, you know, large squadron, very few leaders there. So took a lot off their plate. And then from there, I actually went a step further, and the group superintendent commander grabbed me to go up to there, where I had two squadrons of, I think it was about 1500 people altogether underneath us. So
still in a linguistic capacity?
The linguistic part of it, because it was all linguists and intel people that we were managing. So having that ability and capability to understand them was huge, but a lot of admin type things also, just from a big picture of, you know, it seems like when things go awry, they go really awry with people with security clearances. They don't do anything small. They go all in. So, you know, it requires a security clearance to understand some of that stuff that they do. And it's an interesting world. But, you know, I wouldn't trade my time in the intel world for anything. I did have the excitement and pleasure of being in during 9/11. While that was a horrible time for the country, it was a very noble time to be serving. Yeah. You know, I sat on the floor of the SCIF in the headquarters, and you know, watched the planes fly from into the Pentagon. I mean, it was we had obviously TVs and CNN and Fox News and everybody up on the TVs at that time.
Can you say where you physically were based at that point?
Yep, when... I was based in San Antonio at Lackland Air Force Base. Yep. ANX.
What was that? What was the operational picture like during that day for you in the intelligence community, in linguistics? I mean, are you already moving in certain directions, or are you just kind of taking all that information in at that point?
Everybody was a little bit, you know, once it kind of hit the ground and figured out, hey, this was not just an accident after the first tower, you know, it's kind of like, okay, we all need to start figuring out where is this coming from. So, you know, it was all hands on deck, all ears to the floor, if you will, to try to figure out, is there something out there? I mean, we obviously missed something. So where did we miss it? And what else is, and really what's next? I mean, that was the big thing, is, okay, this has happened. We have to get past that. Although that's huge, the big, you know, it's a hard understanding to think, okay, we got to put this aside. This has already happened. Let's look, is there something else coming, and focus on that. And, you know, well, that's a hard undertaking when you're sitting there and seeing the devastation.
Your transition out of the service was into, I believe, a John Deere dealership or some type of profession. Unpack that a little bit. What was that transition process for you like? How did you know where you wanted to go? How did you first end up at John Deere? And then we can kind of move forward from there.
Yeah. So I said I would never, ever come back to farming. I had no interest in that when I left. And lo and behold, I ended up back here. My father was sick at the time. And so that kind of drove me to back home area. And, you know, I found ag technology quite interesting. And we were at the height of GPS and auto guidance and everything at that point. And really getting into where we had section control of planters shutting off and, you know, row guidance on combines. That was kind of that real strong suit. People were starting to really grab a hold of that. And there was as a linguist and an intel analyst, there's the part of doing the job, but understanding where we get all that information is part of it on the back end. And while I can't get into that, there's actually a lot of similarities in understanding the satellites and how we do that, that, you know, was not necessary to know, but it was a big gee whiz and a great way to have a conversation with a customer to talk about, you know, GLONASS and what that means, and means, you know, using the Russian satellites, and so your line of sight and understanding all that over the horizon so that you don't lose GPS. I mean, there's a when you can talk intelligently about that to customers and have a conversation, relate it back to something like that, it seems to go a long way. So I stepped into a role of technology in the dealership and really talking and educating people about the technology and what it can do for their farm. So really putting together that whole picture of a holistic approach of, we're moving in that direction. Obviously we're a lot further along now, but how can we make your farm more efficient and save you money by using these new technologies? And, you know, I was very successful in bringing people, but then after you brought them onto that side, you had to train them on how to use it and how to make it successful and efficient and build that efficacy across their farm. So I enjoyed it. I loved it. We kind of became the first Raven dealer after Raven brought out a major product for John Deere sprayers at the time, an aftermarket solution. And that was an easy one to go and sell and educate customers on. And I went to Raven for training and ended up with a job out of a situation. So it was a great transition, easy transition. Wasn't looking for anything. I was happy where I was, but I was brought on to Raven in 2016 and I'm sorry, 17, and we haven't looked back.
So I always like to ask the guest, as you moved into the private sector and you're spending time at John Deere and you're moving over to Raven, was there a particular instance, event, or story that you continually reached back to from your time in the Air Force that was an occurrence or something that really stuck with you?
You know, one thing about the Air Force is, against most of the military branches, we're very people oriented and very, very much build relationships. And relationships, whether that been with an airman or a colonel, you always have something to learn from everybody you meet, and building relationships. Relationships are key. And I still to this day believe that relationships are key. It's, you know, people buy from people. And I believe that. And, you know, as I've been around the world doing business development, and now I'm on the strategic team for Raven, how they've chose to do business with us because of the relationship that I've built with these people. It's, you know, we have the right products, but it's really how you treat people and the relationships you build that drive home your integrity and the company's integrity and what you stand for.
Describe, Andy, for us in more detail the current role at Raven right now. You mentioned strategic team, you mentioned some previous work in business development.
So right now I sit on I'm a strategic initiative manager that helps guide the company in the next path that we're going to go on. Right now we're full speed ahead in autonomous solutions. Mm-hmm. And I've taken a big step into the autonomy world when we made the acquisitions to bring these two companies on board. I've been involved in it from many different ways, and that now it's very much out doing some logistics and talking with the customers, that using our products to bring that back and help guide what the decisions are for the next set of features or the next product, and guide through that. Because, and the reason that it kind of fits me is, one, I have the farming operational background, and I've been doing this between John Deere and Raven, and just general farming. Understand, you know, how farmers think, how their operation runs, how they harvest, how they plant. And then on the other side, our historic customer at Raven has always been ag retailers or custom applicators, like Nutrients and Growmark FSs around the world. And, you know, that's been a little bit of a change for us as we come forward with autonomous solutions that's more farmer based. So there's a little bit of a educational gap there that we have to fill and understand, not only of what the retailer needs, but what the farmer needs. And, you know, it's not just a farmer need in the high states. It's different from the Delta to Texas, to the high states, to the upper mid or the upper West Coast. I mean, it's different all the way around.
One thing I noticed in kind of reading ahead of this interview was that you guys have this VSN visual guidance system solution. And I'm curious as to how that may differentiate from typical GPS.
So the visual guidance system actually can see the difference between the color of a corn plant, bean plant, cotton plant, and the ground. So once that plant's about 3 inches tall, it can differentiate that color and actually steer the machine by down the row without using GPS. Now, if you come to an area where there's a waterway and it's all green, obviously there's no row there, so GPS then takes over. It's for a area where it got wet and it didn't grow, GPS will take over. Once it's through that, the camera automatically starts detecting the rows again and picks up and runs through that. And we can use that up to 90% canopy. So once the leaves are 90% over the row, as long as it can differentiate a color, even if the leaves are kind of like this and it sees that dark spot, it can still do that. Once it we hit that threshold of that 90%, or it can no longer differentiate the difference between the color of the plant and the ground or a dark spot in between those leaves, we have radar sensors down underneath on the insides of the wheels that read the stalks and keep us within that row. So it's really allowing that operator in the seat of the sprayer, the tractor, to focus on what they're doing. What are they applying correctly? Are they getting the right rate and all these different things on versus steering the tractor? And it's exhausting. If you've ever ran down rows and it's just like white knuckle driving, gripping the steering wheel as hard as you can all day. And we're running upwards, well over 20 mile an hour with this camera down rows. It's amazing.
And it can switch back and forth automatically between GPS and VSM.
Yeah, the camera, it's all automatic. Yeah.
And because the guidance here sounds like it's sensor-based, cameras, wheel sensors, does that limit the need for connectivity back to any other kind of communication system or infrastructure?
Nope, never. So you always need GPS. You know, that's an integral part of it. But even from there, you always want to have, we always want to promote and be part, have Slingshot as part of the solution, because that's a cellular based modem in there that's in either real time or after the job's finished, allowing the plant manager, the farm manager, the farm owner to look in and see the progress, what's being done, what's going on with that machine, so that they can call his employee and let them know, hey, I want you to do this, I want you to do that. You know, we actually have a software where we can plan their entire day, that we can send the job.
When Slingshot's talking back to the tractor for fleet management over a cell modem network?
Yep, absolutely. Okay. So it's all cellular based, put a SIM card in just like your cell phone and it's connected that way.
How are you guys dealing with broadband cell connectivity issues in some of these more rural areas? Does it require 3G and up, or can it communicate on 2G?
It can communicate on 2G. We don't have a whole lot of problems with Slingshot because it's 30 times more powerful than a cell phone. I was in South Africa for 3 months earlier this year, and we were in areas we had no cell, no bars on our phone at all, and our Slingshot was downloading at 35 megs. So, I mean, there's a lot of benefit. In fact, the rental car I had, I actually put one in it, so I always had connectivity. So I could at least always make a WhatsApp call because I always had data.
When the tractor's working under VSN automation or navigation, kind of air quotes here, if that's the right phrase.
Yeah.
It's not also, is it using GPS as a secondary, or is it not communicating on that channel at all until it reaches a decision point where it can't tell the difference? Then it switches over and then it switches back.
So it's constantly in the background, leaving your breadcrumb, understanding where it's at, so that if you don't have RTK and you're using LastPass or something, it knows where to stay online for that next pass over. So it's, while it's not actively using it, probably it's in the background very much using it and keeping everything in line, because it's kind of like a follow me feature type thing. It's there just waiting to kick in, because if it wasn't there, it'd probably take a little too long to converge and come online.
Are the sensors you said behind or next to the wheels, are those also camera sensors?
Nope, those are just actual radar sensors. It's very similar to the, so we have radar sensors on our boom height control that keeps the boom a constant height off the ground. Obviously when you spray, you have drift worries of bringing drift across, and there's a lot that goes into drift, but boom height control is a big one, and you want that boom to stay a constant height above the ground or above the corn if you're spraying fungicide. So we about a year and a half ago, we revolutionized boom height control, and we changed from ultrasonic sensors, which everyone's used for years, to radar sensors. You know, us, John Deere, all companies have used ultrasonic sensors for the last 15 years probably, and we changed that over to a radar sensor that can read through dust and through spray drift and can read the canopy and ground at the same time. Just gives us a lot more, and it reacts a lot faster than ultrasonic sensors do. So it's given our users a lot better experience.
When you think about adoption long-term, Andy, do you think that the retrofit aftermarket type model is going to be more likely for success, or do you see more of that moving into, you know, OEM integration with like what you have with Case and AGCO?
I see most of it moving to OEM. As the years progress and as technology is further adopted, you know, the cost of technology is not cheap, and it's a lot easier to just put that inside a lease or a purchase on a sprayer than it is to go and put $20,000 to $30,000 worth of GPS and camera systems and everything on after the place, because that's more out of your operating budget than it is out of your machinery and equipment budget.
Given that you guys are so far along in the developmental pipeline, and you clearly own a large majority of the market share when it comes to automation, what's been some of the primary challenges that you've had to getting the technology up to the point where it is today? Adoption aside.
I'd have to default to the engineers a lot on that. You know, when the things that we build don't seem to be overwhelming tasks. It's when we purchased two companies in the last couple of years, and integrating that technology and that software into our systems has definitely been one of our largest tasks. And, you know, we can visualize and say things all day long, but when we go and we have a farm in Sioux Falls that we test at, and we think we have everything figured out, but when you put it in the real world environment, even though it's the same machines, when you're actually running in real crop and real dust and in real conditions, we seem to learn a lot and always have to make some adjustments on the fly. But we have a great engineering team, a very large engineering team that seems to overcome 90% of those obstacles in a very short order.
What can you give me a sense of what those recent acquisitions have been?
Yep. So in I think 2019, November 2019, we made two acquisitions. One, we acquired a company called SmartAg out of Iowa, which was down the path of an autonomous grain cart, taking the person out of that at the time a John Deere 8R tractor, and just calling that tractor to the combine via tablet and kit on the tractor without anybody in it. And then that I've been in South Africa. We've got systems running all over the U.S. right now doing some further testing of that. And at the same time, we acquired 60% of a company in Regina, Canada called Dot. And that was a U-shaped autonomous platform that had a seeder, sprayer, and spreader that could be mounted to it that has no cab, that's ran by a ground control station software that it actually picks its best path plan when you go to that field. And you pretty much hit play and it goes and does its thing. For years, the last 3 years previous to that acquisition, it's been all our technology on board, at least the GPS and slingshots and our field computers were on the Dot. Their GCS software was their own, or at least had nothing to do with Raven at the time. And then in June of 2020, we completed that acquisition. So we own 100% of both now.
Given that these were 2019, 2020 acquisitions, you were ahead of Deere's Bear Flag acquisition and certainly Corteva's partnership with Boston Dynamics. I mean, you think they're playing catch up?
You know, don't ever think that John Deere's playing catch up. I was at in Germany a couple of years ago at the big farm show, and they had some amazing things over there, autonomous drones and things that flew in and out of the box by itself. Bear Flag's an awesome company, and they're going to do great things for sure.
What role do you think, Andy, in the technology that you guys have now, primarily focused on autonomous operation, but so many of these sensors have the ability to collect data that can be used in other areas. And I mean, one of the things that's hot button now is, you know, carbon sequestration and regenerative practices. Do you think Raven and the technology that you have has a role in carbon sequestration within the ag environment? And if so, how?
I think it will gain more and more traction as we build more features into our autonomous solutions. There's going to be a a couple things. One is there's a huge question out there. Are we going to go back? We've gone from small machinery and grown into big, big, big machinery. Are we through autonomy solutions? Are we going to go back into that? And I hate the term, but are we going to start to have small swarms of little tractors and planters and stuff doing things? This is going to give less carbon footprint, obviously. The other side of that I see is like with our grain cart situation, you know, today, if there's a person in it, you're never going to shut that tractor off because it's going to run because nobody wants to sit in a hot cab with got magnifying glass pretty much all the way around it, causing the cab to get, you know, hundreds of degrees and there's sweltering hot. So when we put that feature into an autonomous grain cart where every time it's not being used, it's shutting off, that's going to reduce your carbon footprint by a lot, especially when you're in a low yielding crop compared to corn, like soybeans, wheat, canola, Milo, all that are, you know, half or less of what corn yields is in the I states, where those tractors are running, but they could be shut off for probably half or more of the time.
Yeah, for sure. How difficult would it be to, if we did end up going towards small swarm type robotics with the guise of a lower carbon footprint, how difficult or easy would it be to retrofit what you have now on large scale into some of these small scale devices?
The easy part is making the tractor drive. We already do that today. The hard part is how do we know when there's a wet spot? How do we know when the ripper, the plow gets corn stalks built up in it and we have it's plugged? I mean, are we having using sensors? Are we using cameras? And, you know, in the perfect world, we come up with all this and it shows up an alert on your phone that we all have, just like every other alert that we get that says, hey, the ripper's plugged. This is what it says. Do you want to continue on or do you want it to stop? And then you need to go out there. That's an awesome theory, but how we get there in the sensor technology is pretty unreal. Which is really interesting. You know, this company Smart Ag that we purchased that we now call OmniDrive, you know, started with grain cars because there's not, you know, it's just wheels. There's not a whole lot to it. And the guy sitting and goes back to sitting there in the cab for when low crop, half the time he's probably playing on his phone or doing something completely not benefiting the farm. And if that guy can be pulled out of the cab, and there's obviously tangible ROI with cost, labor, but I think more importantly, it's the intangibles. Let's go have him do something like work ground or put fertilizer on that's going to be economically and agronomically viable and beneficial to the farm itself and the operation overall.
Is there something that you guys are working on now that you can share that would be, you know, blow the socks off some folks?
You know, we're really just focused on autonomy right now. What's coming next? What's the next feature set? You know, I've traveled around the country visiting with these guys using our systems, and it's amazing when you sit there with guys, what kind of ideas farmers really come up with for themselves. Like, hey, well, this would be great, but can we take this to tillage? And if we did it, like, okay, but what about the sensors? Well, just let me be in it with be in the same field as my planter. I'll just put a camera up there and just have a live feed. I can see if it's plugged. I mean, these guys are really thinking outside the box to try to move the needle. And with the labor shortage that we have in the US, especially in agriculture, the need and the vision for autonomy is strong, and they're thirsty for this type of technology.
Generally speaking, is that where a lot of your innovation ideas come from the bottom up, so to speak, from the farmers?
More so now than ever. We've spent a lot of time visiting with the retailers, and we came up with a program probably 4 years ago where we call it Top Gun. We bring retailer operators into Raven, and for 2 days, we give them some training. At the end of that 2 days, and we pay for the hotel and everything, all they got to do is get there. At the end of that 2 days, they sit down for a round table with our senior leadership and with our engineers to give their feedback. They're the ones in the field every day using our products. We want to build the products for our customers. And that has helped more than anything that we've ever done has done. These are the guys in the field, in the trenches, using our equipment. And the managers too, you know, the manager's like, oh, I'd like to have insight to see this while it's running. The guy, you know, like something simple like a camera on the back of the sprayer. You didn't used to be able to use it unless you're in a job in a field. Well, I want to be able to see that back camera when I'm going down the road on my computer to see if a car is driving up behind me that I can't see. I mean, so next software release, we did that. I mean, those are the, that's the invaluable asset of having customers come in and go through training and give feedback. I think the last thing we'll ever see given up, and just in general, is planting and harvesting. And I say that because it's the last two things that a father always turns over to their son on the farm, it seems like. They still want the control of that. And I think that'll be the hard one that we have to give up. I think tillage and rollers and all the other things out there will be given up to autonomy, and rightfully so. It makes sense until we close that gap a little bit further, which interestingly enough, planters are probably the closest thing to autonomous that we have, given the number of sensors already on a planter that tell you every single thing going on behind you.
As we wrap it up, I want to kind of bring back to the beginning part of this and the integration between the veteran community and agriculture. In prepping for this, I was watching some of the marketing videos, and in a lot of the instances, the common theme that I recognized through there was the sense of uncertainty with a growing season and often the chaos that's associated with it at different points. And we've talked about that in general terms in these conversations, but from your experiences in those kinds of uncertain and chaotic environments in the military, I mean, do you see parallels in being able to operate in those environments, having a military background in agriculture? I mean, do you think those are valuable skills that the veteran can bring to this space?
I absolutely do. You know, the one thing about the military is every day was different. And one thing about agriculture, every day is different. Whether you're on a farm or you're in corporate world and in agriculture, I can tell you that every day is a different challenge. And you may have, I've had weeks where I had 15 things planned out and 30 other things came into play, and I may have changed and then changed again. And, you know, in the Air Force, we always had a saying, it said adapt and overcome. And I think that is huge in agriculture. I mean, ask any farmer if any day of their whole life has gone as planned, they're probably going to say no. Whether it's a breakdown, whether it's a product not being launched on time, whether we launch a product and it doesn't do what we think. I mean, there's always different things that have to happen. The self-motivation, the can-do attitude of military people, the drive that they have, and that's what success isn't doing well when everything's going good. Success is how you face adversity and how you overcome that. That's what success is to me. And there's not many people in the world better at that than military people, because there's not a mission out there that goes perfectly. I can promise you. You can plan for a year, and when the day comes, something's going to, whether it's the weather, it just doesn't work that well.
We would always say no plan survives first contact with the enemy.
It just absolutely.
Never happens.
So I think it's a great industry to be in. I think it's, I've been able to see it from every angle, from being at a John Deere dealership, from the guys in sales to the guys in the back working on the equipment, to the technology guys, to the parts guys, to the corporate world. I've been around the world on farms, Russia, Ukraine, Western Europe, South America, Central America, Canada, US, South Africa, Australia, I've been there. And, farmers in general all have the same mentality. They're just get things done. And it's the same mentality you saw in the military. And that's not just, and I say farmers, because that's who I engage with, but it's all anybody in ag. It's just we're going to get this done. Our planting windows and our harvest windows are becoming smaller and smaller, and we're expected to do more with less all the time. And the technology that's coming to ag and the shortage of people that we have, it's an exciting time. And in fact, I say we're probably at the most pivotal point in agriculture since we went from horse and plows to actually having a tractor, because this is this big of a turnover into autonomy and having this. And, I think while you wouldn't think, everybody thinks of agriculture as, getting dirty and out there working, and that's not the case anymore. We're going to start to attract young people from the Silicon Valley that want to come out and run this autonomous machines. It's going to get to a point where you're sitting on the edge of a field at best, if not in an office somewhere running these machines. That's where it's going to go to. And we're taking a huge step in the right direction. And it's exciting. And I can't wait to see what's coming next.
As a linguist in the Air Force, part of Andy's job was not only to process the information collected into intelligence, but also to understand where and how that information was collected. This set of skills continues to prove invaluable today at Raven, as Andy is able to have an intelligent conversation with a grower or retailer about how certain aspects of spatial and guidance information is collected, analyzed, and utilized. I think Andy raises an interesting point that addresses a concern many of us have around autonomous operations replacing humans. His point is not that autonomous solutions will replace that person, rather that the solution can free them up to do something more purposeful or agronomically beneficial. Further, the considerations around keeping a tractor running, for example, in order to keep the driver inside cool and comfortable, go away with no driver when you're able to turn the machine on and off when it's not in use. So ultimately, it will have a positive benefit on the amount of emissions that tractor is generating. Finally, Raven's combination of radar and camera-based sensors as an alternative to traditional RTK guidance seems to have merit, especially in areas where coverage and connectivity are limited. The question that remains in my mind, however, is which of these will ultimately replace GPS as the means by which we enable autonomous operations? Will it be LiDAR, radar, ultrasonic sensors, something like Raven's VNS, or some other optimized combination of all of the above? I don't doubt, however, that in the next 10 years, we will ultimately end up with most of our farm equipment operating without our direct control. But exactly which of these guidance alternatives on the market today will get us there remains something of an unknown. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these stories and insights, please leave us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website at agdconsult.com. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Dessau, and until next time, stay frosty.